0HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, great folks like you. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a wonderful time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, where Ken Jones will be speaking with filmmaker Sandra Luckow about her film, That Way Madness Lies. Have a great night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Yesterday, October 10th, was World Mental Health Day, so it's a fortunate coincidence. Our in-depth guest today is filmmaker Sandra Luckow. Sandra, along with her family, was personally affected by mental illness, and she turned that experience into one of the most moving and important films on the subject, That Way Madness Lies, released in 2017. The film is a documentary about Sandra's brother, Dwayne, also a talented filmmaker, who was diagnosed as schizophrenic when he was 46 years old. Though Sandra lives in New York City, she and Dwayne grew up in the Portland area. She now returns to her hometown to celebrate Dwayne's 60th birthday with a special showing of his films this Saturday, October 14th, at the Moreland Theater. Sandra's currently working on her next film, a documentary, following the last 6 months in the life of writer Kai Emmons, who, stricken with ALS, ended her own life last January through Oregon's Death with Dignity program. Sandra, we talked before about Kai, someone we both love and admire. It's a pleasure to finally meet you in person.
Ken, it's so lovely to be here, and thank you for the help that you've given me in terms of working on Vanishing, a Love Story, the film about Kai, because we are using AI technology to create her voice, something that she had lost before this technology was even available to do. And I used recordings of interviews that you had done with Kai to send to the Ukraine, to this place called ReSpeecher that is creating what's called voice-to-voice technology. And Kai will be narrating her film posthumously.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yes, I interviewed her about five times, Sandra. The first two, she was able to talk. The last three times, ALS had taken away her voice, and she was using a text-to-voice machine. But let's get to Dwayne's event, which is this Saturday. Start a little bit with your childhood. You and Dwayne, born in Centralia, Washington, eventually moved to Clackamas, and you weren't very close as kids, but you both shared an interest in making films.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we moved to Clackamas on Sunnyside Road. My father had bought a tropical fish store at Southgate Tropicals, and we went to Clackamas High School and had a very people say that we had such an eclectic upbringing, but for us it was very much normal. And we are a family of chroniclers. So my father restored antique automobiles. My mother collected vintage antique clothing. My extended family always took 8mm home movies. Dwayne became very much interested in that to begin with.
And some of those films will be shown on Saturday.
On Saturday, we are actually showing a film that he made his junior year in the Clackamas High School American Studies, a spoof on Mission Impossible.
Yes, I've seen, you sent me
the video. Yes, I did send that. Uh-huh. There is a movie that he made when he was 19 years old that won the Northwest Film Center's youth competition in 1980, If Dreams Could Kill. And then he was working with a man named Scott Griffith at Clackamas Community College, who ended up making a making of. And so you will see, for example, the Lloyd Center in all of its glory days of the open-aired shopping center that it was, as he and Dwayne and all of his cohorts literally film in and out of the Lloyd Center in a way that is just, it's going to be a time warp. This wonderful time warp of going back to a time when Portland was considered one of the most livable cities in the country.
Yes, our Keep Portland Weird days.
Yes.
A little different now. But sadly, Dwayne was diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was 46 years old. What were the early signs and what led him to finally seeing a specialist for the diagnosis?
Well, he was diagnosed about 6 or 7 different diagnoses. They kept changing it. People have often asked me, did you see the signs? Well, first of all, you are not considered... You know, to say that he had schizophrenia at the age of 46, the late onset, we were not a family that went to doctors. And so, truly, we were the healthiest family we knew because we never had a diagnosis of anything.
That's a sure way to stay healthy. Huh?
Exactly.
Never see a doctor.
Never see a doctor. So when that happened... Dwayne, you were asking for early signs. We were too close to see it. I think looking back in retrospect, there is such a fine line in the film between the creative eccentricness of our family and what might be considered crazy.
Yes, and maybe the fine line between creativity and what might be considered crazy. There's numerous examples throughout history of artists who weren't quite, sane.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I really wanted to hold this event and sort of produce this event and sort of invite anybody who had had any experience with it is because 10 years ago, Dwayne was living under the Morrison Bridge and on his 50th birthday in a tent filmed himself saying, "It's my 50th birthday." And Portland was really truly in the beginning of its decline to where it is. And there was really not very much hope that Dwayne would probably even survive after he turned 50.
And those clips are included in your film, That Way Madness Lies.
Yes. And now here he is 10 years later, and he is doing very well.
Is that due to medication? I know he was resisting it in the film.
It's not. It's absolutely not due to medication. Dwayne has the only time he has taken medication is when he has been forced medicated by the Oregon State Hospital and the Western State Hospital where he was for a time. However, I've come to the conclusion that not taking the medication was probably the thing that helped him the most, because these antipsychotics are, very strong, and what they do is they help the people around Dwayne manage him. And he was able to sort of work through, and I don't know anything about it. I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV. I don't pretend to be one. But all of the rage and things that were sort of making him go off the rails has certainly stopped. And he's back, you're the same but different. Mm-hmm. He's doing very well, and I think that truly it's something to be celebrated.
And that's kind of a happy ending that we didn't get in the film. It ends with you writing a letter. He requests that you just leave him alone, and that's how the film ends. So it's good to see. There's a prologue here where things end much better. Now, when watching the film, without this happy ending that we know now, I felt for you, your parents, Dwayne, his friends. It made me think more deeply about the people we see on the streets, not only in downtown Portland, but in big cities all over the country. Who need help and can't get it or refuse it. And you point out the big catch-22 in the film, that they can't be helped or forced to take medication unless they request it or are declared an imminent danger to themselves and others, mm-hmm. which apparently is a very high bar.
Right. It's a very high bar, and it is a catch-22. There's a psychiatric joke that basically says the only time you can actually help a patient is when they have the knife at your throat or at their own. And police officers here in Portland, Oregon have often said to me that it is like a bus running towards a brick wall at 60 miles an hour, and you can only step in when it's 6 feet from that wall.
Oh my. And there was another catch-22 in the film, or else a very difficult situation, where if somebody who's homeless and mentally ill is arrested, they can be sent to a state hospital. And the state hospital, if they declare them incompetent or not competent to stand trial, they are sent just right back on the streets.
Right. And what they're taught at the hospital is how to pass that test to get them out back into the street. So they learn the test so that they can be released.
Now, you'll be showing several, we mentioned, of his films at the Moreland, going back to his days at Clackamas High School. There's a senior movie, I think, that might have been one of his first. And we also mentioned that he spent his 50th birthday homeless on the streets of Portland, and he was filming it all on his iPhone, and some of those clips are in your movie. Is he still making movies? He's doing better, we know that.
He is not making movies anymore. However, he is still very much of an artist, in the sense that he has continued to restore antique cars. He has continued to work on, right now he's working on high-end race cars. One of the things that sort of his work that goes back to his films is, a couple of years ago, he was able to restore and work on an exact replica of the Aston Martin that are in the James Bond films.
And I know, as a kid, your dad actually built a gyrocopter out of a James Bond movie, so it runs in the family.
Well, and one of the movies, I mean, the real feature that is going to be shown on Saturday is his James Bond filmed. And, you know, I am a film production professor as well, and I have worked...
A very prestigious one. Well, Yale, Columbia, Barnard.
Okay, you've done your research. And I have to say that in the 25 years of teaching, I have never encountered a group of people, a group of students, especially untrained students, who had such a vision and such an ambition and such a joy for what they were doing, than the people that worked with my brother. And I think that one of the reasons that we can have this celebration, and why I certainly want anyone who was involved with these films at that particular time, is because Dwayne would not be where he is right now if it wasn't for the community of people in this town that supported him.
Now, before we go, Sandra, I wanted to talk about your current project, Vanishing, which we mentioned about the last 6 months in the life of Kai Emmons. And there's a connection to your film about Dwayne. After watching That Way Madness Lies, Kai was convinced, you told me, that you would unflinchingly follow her on this journey. Coincidentally, you also both studied film at Yale. Not at the same time.
But. Well, we did not study film at Yale. We both went to Yale, but we both also went to NYU Film School. And the way that I usually introduced Kai before she passed is I would say, Kai and I went to Yale. Kai graduated summa cum laude. I did not. We both went to NYU Film School. Kai won a Student Academy Award. I did not.
You're both very talented.
When I asked her if this is something that I could do, film the last 6 months of her life, she said, absolutely yes, but I must film her death with dignity, which I did.
And that's where the unflinching part comes in. Well, Sandra, thanks so much for joining us at KBOO. Wishing your brother a very happy birthday and a joyful celebration on Saturday.
Great.
We've been talking live in the KBOO studios with filmmaker Sandra Lucco, whose film That Way, Madness Lies, documents her brother Duane's battles with mental illness and its effect on his family and friends. Sandra will be celebrating Duane's 60th birthday with a showing of his films this Saturday, October 14th, 11:30 a.m. at the Moreland Theater, 6712 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. Also, if you'd like to help finance the film Vanishing, you can go to, Sandra, can you give us the website real quick?
Sure. It is www.vanishingalovestory.com.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your having me on.
This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Street Roots Indigenous Affairs reporter Melanie Henshaw talking about her new article. It's called Tribal Forests Underfunded. Tribally managed forests lack funding to address myriad issues, new report finds. Welcome to the show, Melanie.
Hi, Althea. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. So your new piece breaks down the Indian Forest Management Assessment Team 4, released by the Intertribal Timber Council, and it talks about the status and needs of tribally managed forests. To start out here, who is on this council and what are they analyzing?
It's a nationwide group comprised of various tribal nations, Alaska Native corporations, and other individuals committed to tribal forestry. And for the report, they convene forestry experts to examine tribal forests and forestry while visiting dozens of tribal nations, meeting with natural resource departments, tribal governments, and tribal citizens.
What is the acreage like of Oregon forests that are tribally managed?
So 7 of the 9 federally recognized tribal nations in Oregon manage approximately 516,000 acres of forest land. It fluctuates as land is being brought into trust all the time. And there's also some acreage that may be managed outside of trust or in other ways operated by the tribe. So that's not accounted for in the 516,000 acre number.
So in looking at this report, what were some of the highest priorities for tribes when it comes to managing forests?
Tribes have a slightly different vision when it comes to forest management than the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. Generally, the vision for tribal forestry is more aggressively focused on sustainability and forest protection, and tribal members rate highly the ability to collect non-timber forest products and access their forest for cultural and spiritual means much higher than revenue generation through timber harvest.
What are some examples of non-timber forest products?
Great. So it covers a wide range of products that can be everything from wild mushrooms to berries, fish, grasses, any non-timber product that can be taken out of the forest. And their uses are many. They're used as food sources, as medicines, used in ceremonies for crafting. And that can be through direct use, either by the tribal member or could be used for sale or barter. And like I said, they're very, very closely tied to spirituality, physical and mental health.
Now, you also cover that this report outline some of the challenges that there are when it comes to harvesting these non-forest timber products, and wildfires can play into that. Can you tell me about that aspect?
Some of the issues that these NTFPs, as they're sometimes called, are facing are, you know, habitat destruction, declining populations, and now habitat destruction could obviously come through the form of wildfires. And some of the other issues that are touched on in this report is one of the ways that wildfires are managed are through what's called prescribed burns or controlled burns, which are healthy for the forest, but are often set using a tool called a drip torch, which essentially drips liquid fire onto the ground. I'm not a scientist, so that's my non-scientific explanation of a drip torch. But essentially, that results in chemicals being dripped onto the ground. And in the Pacific Northwest, a really common weaving material is bear grass. And this report found that sometimes the contaminants from drip torches can end up on bear grass, which is then harvested by weavers. And often the weavers are putting this material in their mouths. So that could lead to potentially negative health effects for folks who are using that product. That doesn't say that prescribed burns are negative or bad. It's just a potential consequence of one of the tools that's used.
Yeah, you also mentioned this report that King 5 Washington did about fire retardant and how that impacts some of these products. Can you talk about that too?
Yeah, absolutely. So King 5 Washington recently released a report that found that the USFS, the U.S. Forest Service, dropped retardant on or near water 45 times in the Pacific Northwest between 2012 and 2019, including waterways that are in the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. And that is negative because the retardant that is dropped in the waterways is harmful to fish and other wildlife. And the report found that the errant retardant drops killed thousands of fish, including endangered steelhead and salmon species.
Well, to go back to what you identified in the title of this article, underfunding is one of the biggest difficulties that tribes face when it comes to forest management. Can you break that down? What role does funding or lack thereof play in how this goes?
Right, absolutely. So tribal forests are funded at about one-third of the amount per acre as U.S. Forest Service and BLM managed land. So that underfunding has contributed to many issues that they highlight in the report, such as the infrastructure that tribes have in their forest is in bad condition. And when I'm referring to infrastructure, I mean forest roads and the like. Then tribal forestry departments are understaffed, and the staff that they do have are working with low pay. And the low pay essentially means that these jobs that they have in tribal forestry departments can't compete with equivalent jobs in BLM or the U.S. Forest Service. They have trouble attracting folks to work these jobs in tribal forestry departments. And that issue is also compounded by the fact that there's often poor housing. Now, these underfunded and short-staffed tribal forestry departments are having to contend with immediate threats to tribal forests, like pests, disease, and wildfire.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Can you break down some of the threats that those pose?
Wildfire obviously is a threat that we're facing a lot here on the West Coast and, of course, in Oregon. And these wildfires are burning more and more land, and it's exacerbated through climate change. Due to heavy fire suppression tactics over the past century, these fires are burning extremely hot and even destroying species that are adapted to some level of fire. And other issues that tribal forests are facing are pests like the emerald ash borer, which decimates ash trees, and sudden oak death, which affects oak species, and that's a disease. And now those are two types of wood that are extremely valuable to tribes. So for tribal forestry departments, they need funding, but they also need capacity. They need more staff and more trained foresters in order to address these threats like wildfire, pests, and disease.
How do controlled burns play in? You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but are there times that a controlled or prescribed burn isn't a successful tactic based on the state of forests today?
Yeah, so I actually, in my conversation with one of the co-chairs of the Intertribal Timber Council, he said that essentially once trees and understory foliage in the understory reaches a certain point of maturity, controlled burns are no longer going to be an effective tactic for managing that forest. And you need to go in with what's called mechanical thinning, which is essentially chainsaws, and you're cutting things down. Or they can also put like a toxin into the tree that will kill it, like inject the tree with a toxin. And those are methods that can be used after the certain point has been reached in which prescribed burns would no longer be an effective way to manage that particular forest land.
Yeah, I thought that point was especially interesting. I appreciate you explaining it. What did the report conclude about tribal timber production?
So tribal timber production in the surveys that the ITC conducted was found to be important, but less important to tribal members than non-timber forest products and forest protection. But still important because timber production is used to generate revenue that's often used to fund programs to support tribal members directly, like housing, education, and healthcare. So tribes often are not able to harvest the what's called the maximum allowable cut, which is essentially a metric that's set each year that determines the maximum amount of timber that an entity can harvest from a particular area. Tribes are typically not meeting that, and that's for a variety of reasons, including, as I mentioned, a focus and priority on forest protection and sustainability over revenue generation. But nonetheless, the report quantified how much money was being lost when tribes are not reaching the maximum allowable cut, and found that nationwide it's about $40 million per year lost. So, it, like I said, it's a complex issue where tribes do want to harvest timber for revenue, but it's often not the number one priority. And now I'm speaking very generally here. There's more than 300 tribes in Turtle Island that manage forest land. This report just characterizes generally tribes having a stronger focus on forest protection and sustainability while maintaining some level of importance for revenue generation as well.
So where does the report go from here?
Right. So this is a congressionally mandated report that is produced every 10 years. This is the fourth such report. And from here, it will be presented to Congress before a Senate committee and also before a House committee, where the researchers will present their findings, make their recommendations, and of course be questioned by senators and congresspeople on their findings and recommendations as well. And it's looking like potentially this year they might actually hold this hearing outside, which would be kind of interesting.
That does sound interesting. What are the takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from this story?
Well, I think it's important to note that this is, again, more than 500,000 acres of forest land in sharing space with Oregonians. And so this is important because forestry management practices is, I'll say, a hot topic here in the Pacific Northwest. And I think it's important to highlight that the tribes are managing a significant amount of land and they're doing things a little bit differently. And when I spoke with, you know, one of the co-chairs who wrote this report, he said that generally tribally managed forests are in somewhat better condition than forests managed by BLM or the U.S. Forest Service.
If our listeners are interested, where can folks find a copy of your work for themselves?
Well, you could look us up at streetroots.org, But I would certainly recommend picking up an issue this week from one of our 200 plus vendors that's located throughout the metro.
Love it. Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up here?
Final thoughts are, it's really interesting to see the difference between tribally managed and non-tribally managed forests. And I encourage you to check out this report or the summary to kind of get a better idea of how folks place their focus when their priorities are different.
Well, Melanie, thank you so much for taking the time to walk us through this.
Althea, thank you for taking the time to ask.
That was Melanie Henshaw, the Indigenous Affairs reporter at Street Roots, talking with me about her new article. It's called Tribal Forests Underfunded. Tribally managed forests lack funding to address myriad issues, new report finds. More information available at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Due to technical problems, the Old Mill Variety Hour Indigenous Peoples Day special did not air on Monday, October 9. Instead, we will be airing the program next Monday, October 16 at 9 a.m. Join the Moles to hear stories, poetry, and commentary on efforts to decolonize and reclaim Indigenous ways of being. Music by Fawn Wood.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual fall membership drive. You can help us meet our $55,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $14,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent